Welcome to the Deep Side of Dallas podcast. I'm Paul Corliss, Chief Communications Officer for the University of North Texas System, here with my co-host Rudy Bush of the Dallas Morning News. And Rudy, February, of course, is Black History Month, and our guest for this episode of the podcast really personifies Black history in Texas. Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson is serving her 15th term representing the 30th Congressional District of Texas, which covers much of Dallas County. She's the first African-American woman to chair the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, and is the dean of the Texas Congressional Delegation. This is her final term serving the state of Texas as she is set to retire in January after more than four decades of public service. We are so pleased to have a true legend join us. Congresswoman Johnson, welcome to the Deep Side of Dallas.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to join you.
Well, it's great to have you. And as Paul said, you really do personify a significant portion of our state's history. You've lived through some of the most unbelievable and important changes in our society. You've not only lived through those, you've participated in them as a nurse when you were a young woman, as an activist, and as an elected official. And I just thought I'd start by talking with you a little bit about your childhood, which was in Waco. Now, you were the granddaughter of sharecroppers. Am I right about that?
You're right.
And you grew up there in Waco, really in the 30s and the 40s. And take us through your early years as a child and then as a young woman, and tell us how you found your way out of Waco and into college. You ultimately went to St. Mary's in South Bend, Indiana. But just take us through that story.
Okay. Well, when I was growing up, on my father's side of the family, there were more people who had access to college education. On my mother's side, being the youngest of six children in a sharecropper family, she was the only one that had a chance to get a little bit of college. But my parents were determined that their children would get education. And I decided, after my grandmother, who had been an educator, my father's mother, was ill and stayed with us to get treatment, that I wanted to be a doctor. But my high school counselor said, you should be a nurse. Girls are nurses. And so I switched to nursing. As I was getting ready to graduate from high school, my father said, you must go to an accredited college so that if you should happen to move from one state to another, you won't have to go back to school or take further courses. I really didn't understand at the time exactly what that meant. I do well now. But we started to look for an accredited college of which I could attend. There was not one in Texas. And so one of the school nurses said she knew of a college. She knew one of the doctors there who had graduated from Notre Dame that could tell me about it. Yes. And so we went, my father went to visit him, and he told us about St. Mary's, and we started to communicate. I had to drive to Dallas, and I came up to what was then Baylor University Dental College to take the exam, which I passed. And so that's how I got up to St. Mary's. I rode the train there for the first time taking any trip outside the state without my family. To South Bend, Indiana, to go to college. I've had no regrets. It was a very different and meaningful experience. First time I had been in a very mixed population, with predominantly, of course, Anglo, and rode the train, left Waco one day at 4 p.m., arrived in South Bend, Indiana the next day at 8:30 p.m. Mm. 2 days after I arrived in September, it snowed, and we didn't see the ground without snow until the following May. So it was very different. It was very cold at that time. We were right at the south end of Lake Michigan, and it was nothing for temperatures to go down to 60 and 70 degrees below zero at times. So it was quite a change for Waco, Texas.
I imagine it was. And when you got there, and you've spoken about this in the past, but you said it was predominantly Anglo. Really, you were one of just a handful of African-American students there at St. Mary's. What was that experience like? Was it a welcoming experience? Was it a difficult experience? What are your memories of that?
Well, at times it presented some difficulty, but for the most part, it was a friendly involvement. My roommate was from Champaign, Illinois, and a little Irish woman, and she's passed away now, but we remain very close. And but I must say that it was quite different being in an all-white environment. One of the first challenges I had was finding a beauty shop. Mm-hmm. And I asked one of the people working in the hospital, in the cafeteria, and she told me that I could get a bus and go find Chapin Street, and that would be several. And so after about a month there, I took that chance, found Chapin Street, which looked a lot like a street in Waco, and then found a beauty shop. And I also found and located something I'd never heard of before, and that was Chop Suey Restaurant.
Oh.
So it was quite an experience, change in cultures and a change in locations in the country.
And now you've spoken about this in the past. You said you didn't even really pay attention to your grades, but you were actually quite a good student, and you did very well there. You graduated, of course. And I remember reading about a story where you brought your family up to South Bend. You got them a place to stay. You tried to take them to a restaurant, and it was a really difficult and even humiliating experience. Can you recount that story?
Yes, it was very interesting because I would go with my classmates, and there was never a question since I was the only African-American, but I wanted my parents to see where I considered myself a little hangout when we did get off the campus, and I took them there for dinner, and they kept passing us, and finally I said, we want to order, and she came over and said, we don't serve colors here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally shocked. I said, I come here all the time with my classmates. And she said, that's what I was told to tell you. So we had to leave there. And that was the first time I'd experienced what I'd been accustomed to knowing in Waco. We knew the places we could go and not go there. This was the first time I had to be notified when I absolutely did not know, since I had been served there when I was with my classmates. But my parents were not shocked. We went ahead and I think we went to a place called Hamlet Hamburgers or something. But my parents were quite aware of it because they drove up. I had never driven up, but I drove back home with them. And they were telling me in driving up that they did not get a hotel the whole way because they weren't sure where they'd be admitted. They just drove till my father would get tired, and they'd find a church premises.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd park on the church premises, hoping that would be a safe place to be. When I look back on those days, I realize how much things have changed. And sometimes young people think they never change. But as I look back over my past, there have been tremendous changes. I remember walking by Baylor University, but could not go there. But my sister, who was 8 years younger, left Waco and went to UCLA when she graduated because she wanted to be a nurse as well. But 2 years after she got there, she could transfer back to Baylor, and she did, and graduated from Baylor. So things do change. But when you live it, it's the only way sometimes you realize those changes have come.
Well, and I was curious, Congresswoman, when, you know, when something like that happens to you and your family, and obviously, you know, this was a time of segregation, particularly in the South where you grew up. Did you carry that feeling with you as you moved forward into public service years later and really became somebody who fought for equality?
Well, what my father used to say all the time is don't be bitter, be determined. And once a task has begun, never leave it till it's done. Be the labor great or small, do it well or not at all. And I heard that all of my days in high school. As a matter of fact, I used it in my honor speech when I graduated. Those are my father's quotes. And I remembered that each time. I was so disgusted that I was ready to fight, knowing that fighting would not make things really better. That the only way that I could make a point in making things better was to try to change it fundamentally. And so that's what I tried to do along the way. When you realize that you're only a speck in all the population, that it's unlikely that one person is going to get mad or scream or fight and make any change. You've got to make sure that there are people with you that understand that needed change. When I helped to organize the boycott of downtown Dallas, I was really wanting to go back and show that I was doing pretty well. And I went back to be in my roommate's wedding, not really be in the wedding, but attend the wedding. And I wanted to show that I had done okay coming back to Texas. And I went downtown to shop for a nice outfit and a hat, of course, because it was Catholic. And that's when I learned that A. Harris and Volk, Sanger, you couldn't try on clothes as an African-American. I went to A. Harris to buy shoes. I couldn't try on shoes. But I made it, and I got just enough to get up there and look the way I wanted to look. And when I came back, I grew up being active in YWCA and the Girl Scouts. I went to the YWCA and told Miss Marion Dillard, who was the director, that we had to do something about downtown. I said, I couldn't believe that all these people lived here. Nobody ever said you couldn't try on clothes in downtown stores. And so I got with her and a woman named Imelda Brooks, who is now passed away, and Yvonne Ewell, who was then an educator, and told us my story to them. And we organized about 7 or 8 women, but we called it 50 Sensitive Black Women. And we asked women not to shop in the stores downtown, and that was in the 50s. That was fairly successful. It was Stanley Marcus who opened the Neiman Marcus first. And that's what gave me a little acquaintance with the presence of Stanley Marcus.
Well, let me bring you around to a part of that story that I'm really interested in getting into with you, because I think a lot of people don't know this about your history. And, you know, of course, your name is so well-known now in Dallas politics that it's easy to forget how it all began. But you came back to Dallas, or you came to Dallas after becoming a registered nurse. You got a job here at the VA, and you were working on behalf, you were sending letters out from the VA to, I guess, a regional office or maybe a national office about civil rights and affirmative action within the VA. You were volunteering to help kids get inoculated when you would get off of work. And you were just establishing these little pockets of trying to push here and there for equality. So maybe wrap that into how you became a political person, because I don't really think that's how you started.
Okay, yes. Yeah. When I was at the VA, first of all, when I went to my interview, they were not expecting me. I didn't know that. I sat there 2 hours waiting for an 8 o'clock appointment. I'd gotten there 20 minutes to eight that morning. And at 10 o'clock, they finally came out and asked me to come into the chief nurse's office and admitted that they had been waiting for this nurse that had an 8 o'clock appointment. But he did not show.
Right.
And so I said, well, who was the he? And they said it was a man, Eddie Johnson, that was coming from up around the University of Notre Dame. And I said, I think that's me. And it really was a shocker. But Emma Pope, I think, who was originally from Wichita Falls, Texas, was the chief nurse. And she said, I'm going to hire you. We need you here. And she really stood by all of what I went through out there and kept encouraging me several times. I was about to leave, and she said, don't leave. Well, the regional office at the time was in St. Louis, Missouri. And I would sit and write these letters and describe the situations of which I had experienced and that I saw. And didn't really get much of an answer other than that receiving the letter. So after several years, I got a call from the regional director saying that they were thinking of making some changes. And so they made a change and sent a new director. And when I went out to speak with the current director, I think his name was Buchholz at the time, he had all those letters I had mailed to St. Louis, and I got really nervous because, you know, they were all handwritten. And he said, we have all of this, and somebody has listened, and we're going to make some changes here. And so they sent a gentleman from Maine to the area, and as soon as he got there, he interviewed me, and I started working to help to write a civil rights statement. The person who was kind of my partner out there that would give me encouragement was Alberto Gonzalez.
Okay.
And Alberto Gonzalez is the one that opened that funeral home right there on 35, right as 183 comes in on 35. He's passed away now, but he's got a number of children in the city.
This is this fascinating part of your life to me, because if you read about your life, it is like a catalog of who's who in Dallas history. You worked with Maceo Smith on housing policy. You were close to the Reverend Zan Holmes, who helped to convince you to run for office. You, of course, knew very well Congresswoman Barbara Jordan. So let me just move you into the 60s a little bit, because this is when you really start to get very deeply involved. You were, I think you volunteered for Lyndon Baines Johnson's campaign. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Okay. And did you develop a relationship with President Johnson, or take us into how you really started to dig into the political scene in earnest?
President Johnson was the first person that I had met who was in the top of government in Washington. And I had been a strong Yarbrough supporter. But Benson was very close to the Johnsons. And when I really didn't get really off into real politics until the redistricting thing, the partisan politics. Mm-hmm. I had worked in Emmett Conrad school board election, and several others, just walking. from door to door and passing out materials, but I was a federal government employee, so I knew to be careful. Van Holmes and I were classmates in Waco, Texas. Prior to his father was a Methodist minister, so his father was moved to Austin when we were in the 10th grade. But we had been classmates and kept in touch. When we did the it was really L.A. Bedford who first made the appeal to the Citizens Council, I believe, at the time, that we wanted some representation and had 15 people that were Dallas County state representatives. And they picked Mr. Lockridge because they tried to get Bedford, and he said, I have a family and I can't do it. I got to make a living. So you probably remember that Lockridge was killed in a plane crash.
Well, I read that. I read that actually in studying your history. I had not remembered it, but I remember that he was the choice, and you referred to the Citizens Council then, and people referred to them then as the Great White Father, and that they sort of hand-selected which black people in Dallas would run for which office, and Lockridge was sort of the pick. And then Holmes convinced you to do it. So maybe tell that story.
Okay. After Lockridge was killed in the plane crash, Van Holmes was chosen to be that person. And during that time when he was serving is when it was L.A. Bedford again said, we ought to have single member districts. And those. So the only thing I had to do with that is help to collect money. I went around in neighborhoods and helped to collect money to support a lawsuit to get single member districts. And we were successful in getting single member districts. And then there were kind of neighborhood meetings over in the church that Reverend Holmes had his office, Warren Avenue Methodist Church, that we would meet. And so I was kind of leader in pulling it together simply because I was willing to stay on the course of working as a volunteer. And it was Zan who got up and said, I'm asking for the resignation of Eddie Bernice Johnson from this leadership group because I intend to submit her name as a candidate. And I was in a state of shock because I really was not expecting that. But he kept prodding and I had no clue what I was getting into. And so he and Dr. Conrad both convinced me that I should become a candidate. And so that's how I ended up running for office the first time.
Well, Congresswoman, you know what I find interesting is you talked about as a child getting and getting ready to go to college that you wanted to be a physician, but you were told that women are nurses, right? And yes. Then becoming a political candidate in that day, especially a female of color, seems to be going against every barrier that you could possibly have. So, you know, that mindset to me is fascinating that, you know, you chose to go into nursing because you were kind of told that's what you should do. Yet things were so different as far as how your political career was launched.
Well, that's true because that. The persons who had the least confidence in a woman doing it were black women. Not all of them, because I remember that Yvonne Ewell was still right there, and several other women who were in a group called Jacksonville, where was Organization for Children, that we worked with, were encouraging. But there were so many saying, oh, you sure you can do that? Nobody does that but men. And I said, well, I made my commitment, so I'm going to get out here and see. And Julia Scott Reed, who worked for the Dallas Morning News at the time.
Yeah, a great columnist for the Dallas Morning News.
Yeah, she was one of the people who did not start off with me, but she saw how hard I was working at it, walking from door to door and all. And so she said, let me tell you something. You keep going. I think you're going to do okay, and I think you'll make it. And so she became a real encouraging person, and we became very close. But it was very new for the community. I don't know if any woman had ever even run for an office in Dallas before then that was of color. But
Well, it's interesting because you hit these obstacles at sort of every point, and whether it's racial or whether it's gender. And I think even when you ran for Congress at one point, I think it was the Chicago Tribune who described it as, quote, a dual handicap, or they used some phrase like that as it related to you. And it's easy to forget now just how ingrained the racism and the sexism were, I think, in government. But you tell a story about how the comptroller of the state of Texas, a man by the name of Robert Calvert, openly called you the worst slur in our language at some point in your career. And maybe you could catch us up on what happened with Calvert and how that, I think that in a way, changed the course of Texas government.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, that was really my very first term in office, when there were three of us that were asked to take a look at some of the things going on in the state. And what I had noticed, and what I read some background of Mr. Calvert, is that he always spoke down to women and had them doing little minuscule duties, as if getting his coffee, waiting on him, and that sort of thing. And so I told him that I didn't mind doing a complaint as it related to women. And I think it was Ragsdale who did it as relates to men, African-American men. And it seemed like to me it was a third suit as well. But mine was the one that got the attention. We did win the it was not the courts. I don't know whether it was I'm trying to remember exactly what organization we put those complaints. Anyway, they ruled on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know Mr. Calvert. I think that I went and had a talk with him. And main reason why is because after that determination was made, he said something about that woman, that nigger woman messing with him or something. That was when the Governor Briscoe was governor. So I made an appeal to him to recall and put a recall for his election. And then I made an appointment with him and sat down and talked with him. And we actually ended up having a very pleasant relationship. Because I think that, and that's what I have learned along the way, often people don't realize just how others see what they do and how it falls on them. And I still experience that right now, today. When I sit down and talk to some of my colleagues about how it looks and how it seems and how it's taken, they're sometimes shocked. And that's where I saw Mr. Calvert. He had no clue that what he was doing was that wrong. He just said, you know, women had never had a significant position in his office, and he thought they were there to make sure the coffee was hot and everything they needed was in place. And so I said, but you know, there are women who have to make a living just like men, and they can do the job if they're given a chance. So we had a number of talks. And when he decided not to run again, he came over to the House floor and asked me to step out and said to me, you know, one thing I think you're right about, I've been here too long, I'm leaving. I said, oh, Mr. Calvert, I said, I've come to respect you. And he said, I've come to respect you too, but you were right. I'm leaving. So he chose not to run again. But, you know, he was probably the age then as I am now. And but we kind of left on good terms because I wasn't really trying to just embarrass him. I was trying to bring about some change and new attitudes.
That's so interesting to me because I feel like we're at a point in our politics today where that possibility of forgiveness and recognizing that, hey, someone has done something, the thing he called you was unacceptable, and it was public in a way. It became public, certainly.
Oh, it was, yeah, it was quoted in the paper, so everybody knew it.
And it was absolutely horrible. And for you to approach it as a possibility of him either changing or recognizing that his time was past, I mean, how do you put that in perspective to the way it seems like our politics is going today? And it's on the left and the right, but sticking with your party, you know, for just a minute, that it seems like when I see progressives even talk about your career or people who are maybe to your left, I don't get this sense of the same forgiveness or willingness to have that openness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that's one thing that's missing now is the communication, the explanation of what you feel like when something like that happens. I think that I get the feeling now that young people think that when you do that, you don't owe it to the people. I always felt that I needed to understand the people who had those kind of policies or that attitude to see how they arrived at them. I still do that. Let me digress just a minute. Last week, a week before last one of the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus went to get on the train to ride over to the Capitol. And one of the members, a senior member, didn't have on a mask. And she asked him if he put on a mask. And he said, I'll put it on when I get there or something anyway. She said, I'll get off the train because this virus is serious. And he said something about you go to hell. I knew that man.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been on trips with him, and I'd worked. He's got the poorest district in the country, and we've worked together on policy related to poverty and all that. And I saw him the next day on the elevator, and I said, let me tell you something. I know you. I really feel like I know you. And he stuck his hand out with tears in his eyes. I think that often we don't understand each other. Because we're so, right now, it's worse than I've experienced it. And I attribute it to this redistricting where it's so extreme. You've got divisions that almost punishes people who try to work across the aisle and try to develop relationships, which is most unfortunate. It's not going to help this country.
I agree.
But we don't give each other the opportunity sometimes to make a mistake.
Well, and I think what's been interesting, Congresswoman, is this is maybe the third example we've heard of situations where maybe that the average person would have gotten angry and lashed out. And I just love the thought of that, you know, you process in your mind and you approach things in a calm way. And it feels like maybe that's something that served you throughout the decades of service.
Well, it has. I think right now with my committee, we've done some tremendous things. And before I chaired that committee, we had a colleague of mine from San Antonio. It was the most contentious experience that I'd had on that committee in all those years. Mr. Hall had chaired the committee when I became ranking member. And we had worked together. We had people who had been very liberal and people have been very conservative. But we've not had anyone who denied science and tried to unravel it. When we got, and this is no secret, Lamar, everybody in Washington knew that. But I just stayed right with him and told him I couldn't agree with him. I didn't have the numbers to overturn him, but where we could work together, we would. And that's what we did. He's visiting my office a lot now. But I made up my mind when I became eligible to be chair of this committee that we would not have that same attitude in the committee. Everybody there had to be respected as an individual that had some ideas they wanted to put on the table. But it was going to be based on science, not on ideas or hearsays. And that's what we've tried to do. And we have passed more bipartisan legislation, I think, than any committee in the House. But it's because I took my time to give them input and go with the science and move ahead. Now, we just passed in the House that $550 billion science bill called COMPETE. We had 16 bills that had passed the House with bipartisan votes when we had to have a vote, because some of the major bills that we passed were passed with voice votes on the suspension calendar. But I didn't mind taking the time to hear people out, calling individuals, checking out witnesses that came from their areas to see if we tried to get the best witnesses available. And if they lived in an area you thought they would be saying things against where that member was, we called the member to see how they felt about it, because you can always find good witnesses if you look. And so I've tried to give everybody their due respect. One thing I understand, people are products of their environment. And they can learn beyond that, but they have to be given that opportunity.
Right. That's right.
And if you jump on somebody just because of that and don't understand, don't let them explain, you might ingrain them more in an attitude than if you give them an opportunity to make a modification. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's interesting because people often talk about, oh, maybe we're just nostalgic for what Congress used to be or something like that. And no one is pretending that Congress was ever, you know, a playground or that partisanship didn't exist just as much in the 70s and 80s. But I do believe that it has fundamentally changed in a way that it is less effective, that our government is less effective than maybe it has been since the Civil War. I don't know historically, but it's really troubling. And I hope people who are listening to this are listening to what you're saying about figuring out ways to reach across the aisle and make things happen, even if it's not perfect. I mean, am I wrong about that, Congresswoman? Am I getting that sense of bad things are wrong?
Very honestly, I'm very concerned about where we are now. I don't see how a democracy can survive until we take stock of where we're headed if we don't begin to talk to each other and understand where each are coming from. The way we are setting up these lines, which is very unfortunate, they're being drawn by computers, and a computer can divide a bedroom. And it seems that it gives the voices of the extreme the best opportunities. And I can't say that I don't agree with some of the voices of extreme. But you have to understand that everybody living has an opinion. And if you want yours respected, you have to at least listen long enough to respect theirs. And they can be as wrong in your judgment, but in their head, they're right. And when you think about that, when you think about the fact that you'd like to convince them that your position is the right one, then you got to give them an opportunity to tell you why theirs is the right one. And you begin the conversation. We're not having those kind of conversations anymore. It's so interesting to me that when I started to explain some of the reactions I had on certain things, I have people that grew up in my generation said, I never knew that. And I have a very dear friend who played football with my brother in Waco, Joe Barton, who was a conservative Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe has said to me, you know, I didn't even realize a lot of this stuff was going on. It was just kind of routine life. He said, how did your brother get to high school with me? And I said, well, that was the first year that they desegregated schools, and he went to Waco High. And I went to A.J. Moore. All three of my other siblings went to A.J. Moore. He was the youngest one. And he said, we didn't know. I was in Congress. I didn't know that my brother had played football with Joe. Joe and I were debating. When I first went up there, they had these debates at night. And we were debating the environmental stuff. And I said, you know, I'm a nurse, so I care about the health. And he said, well, we have to have jobs, whether you're healthy or not.
Yeah.
And so we'd go on and on, and we'd laugh about it. And we'd say, as long as we don't attack each other personally, we can bring up any subjects we want to. So I came home one weekend, and my brother said to me, don't beat up on my friend so much. And I said, who's your friend? He said, Joe Barton. I said, Joe Barton? He said, yes, we played football together at Waco High. And I went back and I said, Joe, do you remember a football player named Carl Johnson? He said, yes. I said, that's my baby. I said, that's my only brother, but he's the youngest in the family. And he said, I never would have put you two together. He said, but now that I think about it, he had a lot of ways, like you said. It took a long time to get him worked up, and he was always mild. And when my brother got sick and was diagnosed with cancer, Joe came to see him, came to the funeral and all that. And so it is just, to me, it's an example of sometimes people not taking the opportunity or the chance to listen to each other. When Joe tells me about things that happened and he didn't understand growing up, he said, I was just never that way. I just thought that's kind of the way things were, but I never really thought about anybody mistreating anybody. He said, and my family didn't say anything about that in our home. We never talked about mistreating Black people. And so I think that's what's missing in our dialogue.
Our conversation with Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, a true icon in Texas and American history, will continue in the next episode of the Deep Side of Dallas podcast. Be sure to tune in as we dig deep into her political career, including relationships with Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Feel free to email us at deepside@dallasnews.com with questions, comments, and ideas. For Rudy Bush, I'm Paul Corliss. We'll talk to you soon.